Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. It is October 24th, 2018. As always, I thank my friends and listeners for their financial support. It's the only thing that keeps me on the air. It's a terrible shame that although a very skilled teacher and professor, always the most popular professor wherever I go, I'm unemployable in academia. And I'm unemployable because I'm very good at what I do. It's the only field in the world where you can actually deliver a product that exceeds expectation and be punished for it. My student evaluations going back to when I taught at Nebraska as a 24-year-old are almost uniformly laudatory. And it's been a great source of pride for me. There aren't many things that I do well. And the one thing I do well, other than making cute babies, of course, which I'm very good at, other than that, the one thing I do well, you know, I can't do. But I'm quite pleased to have the independence and the freedom that this, my research, and all of my publications afford. I know there's a lot of academics, anyone who's listening to this show, envies me, because I could say whatever I want. They can't. Today we're going to talk about a gigantic topic. There's no way I could write hundreds of volumes and not come close to probing the perimeters. And that is the Jewish influence on the Protestant Reformation. The Reformation is the greatest disaster in European history. It was worse than both world wars, worse than the Black Death, worse than the Hundred Years' War, worse than the Spice Girls, worse than any disaster that has ever been imposed on European man. It tore Europe to pieces. It led to ideological chaos. It was one of the necessary ingredients to the development of capitalism, individualism, and of course the parent ideology here, nominalism. After William of Ockham, it's the reformers who introduced nominalism into European life as a real workable metaphysical and theological category. Now, to call it a reformation is to misunderstand it. Catholics and Orthodox alike wince when people call it a reformation, because it was nothing of the kind. That's like calling the U.S. Constitution a reformation of the Articles of Confederation. No, they threw it out, and they wrote something brand new. It was a revolution in thought, culture, and every aspect of life. My view of the matter is that it rejected truth as such. Because if you're going to be consistent and say that the immensely lengthy, dense, and detailed words of the 74 books of the Bible, and I want to make a note here, the Bible is itself a Protestant creation. We have scriptures, which include far more than just the 74 books of the Bible. That is a compendia of essential works, primary source documents. Those aren't the only things that incorporate scripture. The notion of this book, which contains the entire faith, is a nonsensical idea because it's based on the heresy that human words are sufficient to communicate everything that God is. Anyway, if you're consistent on sola scriptura, then there is no truth. The only thing that exists is will. The Enlightenment, of course, is unthinkable without the Reformation. It's a revolution that led to the development of secularism. And whenever you hear the word secularism, and whenever you hear the word revolution, in a European context, you immediately begin searching for a Jewish root. Now, of course, if academics were rational and free, that's what they would all do. But they're not, so they can't. There is no heresy in the Christian world. There is no revolution, in the true sense of the term, in the Christian world that didn't have a Jewish foundation, or at the very least, had tremendous Jewish influence. Moses Maimonides, the great Talmudic scholar, very rarely read by anybody. Sometimes when people want a virtue signal, they cite him. He says this: when Israel, and he's referring to Talmudists in that sense, when Israel meets the conditions for observing the Jubilee, it's forbidden to allow an idolater among us. Even a temporary resident or a merchant traveling from place to place shouldn't be allowed to pass through until he accepts the seven universal laws commanded to Noah and his descendants. And as the verse states, they shall not dwell in your land, even temporarily. A person who accepts these seven mitzvot is a gertel shav, a resident alien. Now we get to the Noahide laws here in a minute. The central exegetical principle here is that Jewish elites, especially because they are always a tiny minority, can never be taken at face value. The words that they use are symbols. Words have a connotation and a denotation. The denotation is what you read in the dictionary. The connotation is defined in context. All Gnostic sects, most modern ideologies, Judaism, modernism, etc., all Gnostic sects have an esoteric and an esoteric side. The exoteric is for the common people. It's the first three degrees of Freemasonry. The belief that Gnosticism is against the corruption of the clergy. You have Harvard professors saying this. You know, idiotic statements like that. That's the exoteria. That's for the idiots. That's for those who have absolutely no critical skill and who take everything that they're told at face value. The esoteria, of course, is the truth. That's what they actually believe. That is rarely, if ever, written down. When it is written down, it uses code words. There was a great debate whether or not the Talmud should ever be written down at all. And when it was, they needed to make certain that certain words were encoded. This is classical alchemical thinking. The alchemical movement, which is a social movement, not a scientific movement. The alchemical idea is based on Kabbalah, and therefore based on the Renaissance, which itself was created by the Medici family. The entire Italian Renaissance was created by one banking clan. Now we'll get to the seven Noahide laws later, but idolatry is the central concern. And the Talmud, Orthodox people, Catholic people, anti-Semites are idolatry. Not that long ago, great Christian centers of the world burnt the Talmud. But because it's so huge and rarely to be seen, no one knows what's in it. You've never seen an abridged version in a bookstore. It's nowhere to be found. You have to go to research libraries. I've read the entire thing. I read, believe it or not, the Socino translation, this big, beautiful, blue, multi-volume set at the University of Nebraska Library. But you have to go to a place like that to find it. It is not for the profane. Technically, I'm deserving of death for having read it. I'm certainly deserving of death for being Orthodox and for talking about the Jews. Truth of the matter is that living as a minority, they're always a minority, whether it be Catholic Poland or Orthodox Ukraine, which is, you know, when the Reformation began, 80% of the Jewish population lived there. What do you do when you're a tiny minority, wealthy, but without any institutional political power? Well, they need to defang, so to speak. They need to take the teeth out of the religions that they despise. They need to fulfill the promises of both the Talmud and the Zohar, or one of the books of the Kabbalah. The Reformation was precisely this method. It is not exactly an accident that the Reformation occurs precisely at the time when the Medici clan introduced the Kabbalah and called it the Renaissance. At the same time, the peak of Jewish power in Poland and Ukraine on the one side and Holland on the other, creating a, after the expulsion from Spain, creating a triangle. That would be Holland, Amsterdam and Antwerp on one side, over to Krakow, and then meeting the point in Constantinople. London will soon make it a square. The fate of Jews in Tuscany was completely and utterly linked to the Medici house. Jews were always in that part of Italy, but a network of Jewish banks had spread all over the place by the beginning of the Renaissance, even the middle of the 15th century. Florence, Siena, Pisa, these were all political creations of the Medici clan. They took shape by the beginning of the Renaissance. Again, not an accident. The Renaissance refers to a rebirth, but a rebirth of what? Well, if you take a university class, you'll be told that this refers to the rebirth of classical learning, as if it was somehow interrupted in the Middle Ages. Well, that's Jewish propaganda. Of course, there was never a moment when the great classics of the Greco-Roman world were not studied and celebrated. Nowhere, but in Orthodox, especially in the lowest points of European history, were these, you know, obviously Aristotle was an essential figure. In the West, Plato was always a dominant figure. Virgil especially. There was never a moment when these people were ignored. So it takes, 30 seconds to blow away your typical textbook reason for what the Renaissance is and what it's supposed to be. No, it's the resurrection of the Kabbalah. It's the resurrection of paganism. Let's be clear. Judaism is not religion in the sense that there is no God. There is no doctrine. It is a political ideology based on a messianic revolutionary idea. That messianic idea is what we would call the Antichrist. So the Kabbalah is what's so-called reborn and what's put to the forefront by banking money. That's such an artificial way to make money. The Kabbalah made a lot of sense to them. Your freshman year in college, you'll read Pico della Mirandola, and he is the first guy to use the ultimate oxymoron, the Christian Kabbalah. The Kabbalah comes into existence to negate Christianity. And the Christian Kabbalah, and the fact that that's taken seriously in academia, really shows what these people are. The rise of numerology. Now, numerology had always been significant. Numbers were never just numerals until the postmodern era. They were icons. They were symbols. Numerology, though, is not the same thing. Plato said the universe was constructed of numbers, but he doesn't actually mean the number 2 and the number 3 that you're taught in the universities. And I've heard that being taught by a dozen professors at least. That's not what a number is. A number is an icon. It's an aspect. It's an archetype. It's an aspect of the form of truth. Numerology is something else. Numerology is an attempt to dominate and control nature through these archetypes. Della Mirandola asserted that all the sources he used in building his system, Kabbalah was the main one. Kabbalah, the regime calls it Jewish mysticism. I don't know what they mean by mysticism, but it's simply pagan alchemy with a Jewish supremacist element to it. That's taught in secret. But the Christian Kabbalah, as ridiculous as it is, became an object of serious study. Isaac Newton, Milton, Leibniz, even Shakespeare was familiar with it. And Martin Luther was quite familiar with it. Now, he studied the Kabbalah, but he did put it aside. The Talmud was far more interesting to him. Now, another code that's used, even academics will use this, is a study of Hebrew. When they say the study of Hebrew or the Hebrew language, they're not referring to the language. Very few Jews knew Hebrew at the time. The study of Hebrew, or even the phrase Christian Hebraist, refers to the Kabbalah itself and the Gnostic revolutionary occult doctrine that it manifests. One of the main connectors from the neo-pagan revival, that's the Reformation, the Renaissance in Italy, and the Reformation in Germany, is Johannes Reuchlin, who met Pico in 1490. And Reuchlin was a philo-Semite who soon believed that the Jews were superior to everyone else, intellectually speaking. And he brought in Kabbalists and Talmudists from the centers of Jewish power that I've just mentioned. Obadiah Sforno and many others. The Jewish doctrine was always kept secret, even to this day. But so long as Catholics and Orthodox remained firm, Moscow, Constantinople, it was very dangerous to speak of this stuff. We've spoken on this show about the Judaic heresy in Novgorod and how it's funny to watch the modernist or world Orthodox try to deal with that. They usually just don't. Or they misrepresent what they believe. They use the most ridiculous descriptions. They were opposed to icons and corruption. Well, you have major textbooks that say that. But the rise of the Medicis was not against the interests of the Jews. But the rise of this triangle that I mentioned, this changed everything. Kabbalah was promoted heavily just before the Reformation began. Actually, I should say really even before people like Abraham Azulai, one of the great Jewish nationalist leaders at the time. And Azulai, of course, made the claim. Well, he says this. Azulai says, I found it written that it has been decreed above forbidding open involvement in the wisdom of truth, which by him Kabbalah. It's only meant for a limited time period until the year 1490. That is our year, 1490. The Nan is called the last generation, and what was forbidden is now allowed, and permission is granted to occupy ourselves in the study of Zohar. So from the year 1540, it is most desirable that the masses, both great and small, should occupy themselves in the study of Kabbalah, as it says in the Rai Hema, and not because of the merit of the Messiah, or what we would call Antichrist, will come in the future, not in any other reason, not in any other merit. It is not proper to be discouraged from its study. So this and dozens of other Jewish statements strongly show that the Enlightenment and its predecessor, the Renaissance and Reformation, have a Jewish foundation. It is a way to bring Jews to power without anyone knowing. Everything is based on the manipulation of language. The Judaizer heresy, and before that, the Strigoniki, were blatantly Jewish movements that use Gentile frontmen and whose doctrine simply will not be dealt with. Even in very, very good histories of Russia, the doctrine is not secret. The doctrine, I mean, there's, you know, mostly exoteric, but you could read between the lines. You have to know what you're talking about, but, you know, these were means of destroying Christian nations. And in the Russian case, it was a strong metropolitan, Gennadius of Novgorod, and Tsar Ivan III. And had Ivan III not taken Novgorod and eliminated the Philo-Semitic elite there and the feudal elite there, Judaizers would have taken over the entire area. It was the Third Rome, explicitly the concept of the Third Rome, that destroyed these movements. Rome, as a concept, is singled out for hatred in the Talmud. But so long as this Rome was strong, open study of Talmud or Kabbalah was absolutely out of the question. Reuchlin in 1506 published his Rudiments of Hebrew, and is said to be the first Hebrew grammar. Well, there were many, many Greek and Latin people who knew Hebrew. Very few Jews. But there was regular translations, you know, from Jerome onward. There was no need for a new Hebrew grammar. So what is he talking about? Well, Hebrews is a code for Kabbalah itself. It was a propaganda tool. The study of quote-unquote Hebrew became so fashionable in German circles, humanist circles, that you had a huge explosion in the number of professors studying this in German universities. So the rise of the Kabbalah meant now that Jewish ideologies could take a pseudo-Christian guise and then eventually lead to a revolution once the ideology of Christianity was hollowed out. The concept is taking interpretation out of the hands of non-Jewish institutions, mainly the Church Fathers, you know, or even the papacy. And a new group of writers with knowledge of Jewish revolutionary doctrine should take over. This is the very nature of modernity. Kabbalah, when it, whatever its guise, you know, alchemy, masonry, you know, rationalism, so-called free thinking, nonsense like this, whatever you want to call it, it made it possible for Christians to accept Jewish control without requiring conversion, since of course there is no conversion to Judaism. It might even be said that the Reformation as an ideology, although maybe not Luther personally, took the idea of Kabbalah and made, and the fact that it gave the argument for sola scriptura, that once you know the secret doctrine of numbers and letters, which is really what they mean by Hebrew, then and only then can the hidden teachings of the Old Testament be brought out. In other words, the scholar at a university, armed with this knowledge, can interpret scripture, not the papacy, not a synod, not a father, not a saint, only with the code that they then impose on the Hebrew text. And this is where this is one of the foundations for sola scriptura, that once you have the code, all you need is you as a scholar and the Hebrew text. Sola scriptura didn't necessarily mean that every moron could simply read, you know, this stuff and try to pretend to know it. That's what you have today. It means more than that. It means that you don't require Christians to explain to you what it is. The Bible is not self-interpreting. In fact, it's one of the most difficult works, especially in certain parts anyway. And the culture of the day is so distant from ours that there really is no point of contact. It's an extremely difficult. One of the things, you know, when the Church Fathers say you have to be an ascetic to even begin to understand it, what they mean is you have to cut yourself off from the world. Because the world as we know it now is the complete opposite of what it was then. And there is no way you could avoid, and you know, projecting that kind of thing onto the text of really any ancient text, but certainly the Old Testament. So understanding the Bible in accordance with its Kabbalah-inspired Hebrew meaning became a defining principle of the Reformation. Now you have professors say, well, you know, no longer were people told what the Bible said, you know, they learned it for themselves, which is utter garbage. No, it's understand it, understanding the, with the understanding of the code that then unlocks the key to the truth of the actual letters and numbers in the text itself. So in 1532, Luther published his German translation of the Tanakh, made directly from the Hebrew. There again, Jewish elites and the Kabbalah injected itself into German Christianity. It was Reuchlin who fought the Dominicans and others to ban the burning of the Talmud. The Dominicans, of course, Russians have been doing it for a long time in Constantinople prior to the takeover. Burning the Talmud was a way to say that this pornography will not be tolerated. Jews were the first to take credit for the iconoclasm of the Reformation. Abraham Halevi, for example, he wrote that Protestants destroy and burn the image of their gods, and their idols are cut down in all parts of Luther's dominion. In other words, the ancient Noahide laws, or what they think are ancient Noahide laws, are being, for the first time in Europe, accepted because of Luther. I don't believe Luther was aware of this. He certainly flirted with demons when he dealt with the Kabbalah and brought these people into his circle. because again, it was local merchants and aristocrats that protected him. He would be nobody if it wasn't for those who made sure that he was never shipped off to Rome. Joshua Hakon says this: "No longer were graven images set up or homage paid to the saints as before, and even Abraham Ibn Maghaz, who was the, as is always the case, a Jewish personal physician to the Sultan Suleiman in Constantinople, said, 'This congregation has cast off all faith in icons and priests and has discarded the form of this worthless creed.'" Murano from Spain, Samuel Usca, who wrote The Consolation for the Tribulations of Israel, and he says this to the rulers of Europe at the time: "You should consider how much harm you bring on yourself by compelling Jews to accept your faith. This forced conversion of Jews to Christianity could come to no good, because such converts will vent their anger on the new faith. For these ways, in the end, became the means to undermine and destroy you." This is typical of Jewish hysteria and exaggeration. Fuske believed, of course, that Jews alone were human because they alone had the divine spark, i.e. reason. But because the alleged forced conversion, which I could rarely find examples of, they converted voluntarily for this, but only because only to make sure that they could penetrate Christian institutions without being detected. But they still remain Jews. And so Usca and many other Muranos say that they then become a tool against their so-called persecutors. So he says, "Since throughout Christendom, Christians have forced Jews to change their religion, it seems to be a divine retribution that these Jews, that is, Muranos, should strike back with the weapons that are put into their hands to punish those who compel them to change their faith." He then says, "A generation," talking about the Spanish exile, "the generation of converts has spread all over the whole realm. And though a long time has elapsed, these converts still give an indication of their non-Catholic origin by the new Lutheran beliefs which are presently found among them, for they are not comfortable in the religion which they received so unwillingly." Samuel Usquiz is an essential figure here, because he is saying that the Muranos, now there's mainline historical scholarship that show that the Muranos were deeply involved in the Counter-Reformation, especially in the Jesuit order. But even more significantly, that the Muranos became Lutherans. And Usca and many other Jewish writers at the time make it very clear that Muranos were penetrating Lutheranism because there the revolution can be brought about more rapidly. Of course, very few Jews were ever forced to convert. What they're referring to is their voluntarily converting for the sake of what they consider their own self-protection. What it meant was that they could, you know, join convents and go to church and everything else and spread ideas under the guise of being a convert. So they went underground to live a secret Jewish existence. Today, they say this is to avoid persecution, but the only thing that was ever persecuted was the Talmud. But even a passing knowledge of Christianity will show that if conversion isn't willful, it isn't a conversion. The term conversion assumes willfulness. But this refers, you know, when these guys went underground, the force that led them to do this was a desire to neutralize the Jewish penchant for revolution and will to power. One of the proofs that it's the Talmud that's being condemned here, and rightly so, was that the Samaritans and Karaites, especially the Karaites, were never considered Jews in the normal sense of the term. Karaites were never expelled from anywhere. This refers to Talmudists and Talmudists only. The term Jew at the time referred only to those under the rabbis. It was the Talmud that created contempt for Jews. E. Michael Jones, a personal friend of mine and one of the great authors of my development, says this in his famous book, The Revolutionary Jew: "The political implications of the Luranic Kabbalah seem clear enough. The Messiah must now wait on man's efforts. He can only come once the process of Tikkun Olam, or the purification, the repairing in the world. And healing has been accomplished by man, that is, by the Jews here on earth, who act as the vanguard of redemption, much as the Communist Party at a later date will function as the vanguard of the proletariat. Without Tikkun, it is impossible that the Messianic King come, according to Isaac Luria. From here, it is but a short leap of thought to the conclusion that Israel had become its own Messiah. Or, as Solomon says, by transferring to Israel the historical nation, much of the redemptive task formerly considered as the Messiah's, many of his distinctive personal traits, as drawn in apocalyptic literature, were now obliterated. Judaism, after the destruction of the temple, became a elitist cult based on the denial of logos. E. Michael Jones put it this way, and it's extremely useful. Logos not only is reference to Christ, it's a person, but it means word. Now, most people don't know what that means. That term, the word word, refers to archetypes. It refers to the forms of Plato that are created entities, but are collected in Christ's own being. These are the means by which nature was created. So denial of logos is more than just the denial of Christ as man or as God. It's a denial of meaning. To deny logos is to become anomalous, to reject that truth exists outside of human convention. Philo of Alexandria, who I've spoken about, was the first to develop the notion of vibration that became so essential to the far left in the 20th century. What they call God created the world through his literal word, that is, vibrations through the air, actual utterance. And objects are differentiated from one another relative to the level of their vibrational frequency. Since the imperative was to deny logos, they'll go so far here that the actual word that is logos, Christ, archetype, is transformed into an actual literal word that one speaks in language. Now, of course, this is crude and only exoteric. What he means, of course, is that the command over language is command over reality. Remember, in Kabbalah, there is no God. In Judaism, there is no God. Now, in Philo's time, there was, but not in 2018, and not during the Renaissance. Academics and journalists, you know, they read these things and they take the language at face value, completely ignorant of the fact that groups like this never say what they mean. There's one doctrine for us, the Cowans, and there's one doctrine for them, the elite. So when they say things like God or good works or Hebrew, when they say words like God, they mean the God of the Bible, the I Am. Of course, it means no such thing. The very fact that they say it doesn't mean they mean it. They use a contemporary word and a common word. They have the husk of that, which is very Kabbalistic to begin with, and fill it with something brand new. The God, so-called, is the Ein Sof. This is the flux. This is the flux that Nietzsche made the starting point of his idea. Ein Sof is nothing. It's prime matter. Prime matter is literally nothing, but of course it's something. It's simply matter without form, which is inconceivable. But this nothing, this Ein Sof, can only be formed like clay into something real by Jews, because they alone possess reason, which is what they mean by the divine spark. So they can take reality, that includes you and me, and mold us through revolutionary doctrine. This is what we know, of course, as Gnosticism. Isaac Luria says, redemption is no longer a divine release from the punishment of exile, but a humanly inspired transformation of creation itself. This is the nature of revolution here. The Kabbalah is based on the idea of the klipah. It's a shell, or a husk, maybe. We consider it a form that has to be filled with something. Luria has, Luria's Gnostic notion says that the evil world, including us, can only be changed by revolutionary doctrine, their own interventions. So instead of evil being a matter of personal vice, it emanates from evil things in an evil universe. And only when you know the vibrations of objects can you understand practical Kabbalah, which is just another word for practical magic. Sholem and others to say that. Practical Kabbalah is what we would now call, you know, science and technology. Replacing nature with elite ideology. You know, these sparks of reason have been tricked, so to speak, into being admired in matter. And we could trick them back out again by holy fraud, as Chaim Vital once said. Holy fraud would include the Murano movement. Holy fraud would include the manipulation of language, saying one thing and meaning another. And its embodiment intensely, of course, is in the so-called Messiah, Sabbatai Zevi. And it would exist long before his death. This means the Jews were dedicated to revolution. This conception exists as ancient as the debate against Philo, as we've spoken about on this show. The earliest church fathers spoke of their denial as logos as revolutionary. There is no meaning in the world. The elite give it meaning, but the elite refers to the rabbis. The Kabbalah, which is now essential to the Protestant Reformation, has nominalism as its foundation, which is what the Kabbalists will call quicksilver, that which disintegrates everything, taking matter that exists in a formed state that actually has qualities that we could perceive, and remove those qualities and make it into this completely plastic prime matter that could be made into anything. Now, it's 1492, just before the Reformation in Germany. The Jews tried to penetrate Russia. There was another Rome that they held in utter contempt. 1492 is a sacred year for the Kabbalists. The Reformation, as everyone, the major Jewish Kabbalists at the time said, the Reformation is essential. It's a major step for the rise of Antichrist, which of course they call the Messiah. Eliezer Halevi, for example, says that Luther was God's agent sent to destroy Rome before the world's end. And of course, really, Rome is the ancient Talmudic term for political goyim, for lack of a better phrase, the root of all social evil in the Jewish mind. Halevi claims to have written even before the Reformation, as early as 1478, 1480, and he claims to have predicted Luther by prophesying back in 1479, a man will arise who will be great, valiant, and mighty. He will pursue justice and loathe debauchery. He will marshal vast armies, originate a religion, and destroy the houses of the clergy. And all this, of course, pointed to Luther. He lay bare the pretense of Rome and expose her ignorance. And in the 1520s, he went so far as to connect Luther to Cyrus. In other words, a non-Jew acting as God's agent. It is now evident, he says, that he alone, meaning Luther, is none other than the man mentioned above, who is exceedingly noble in his undertakings. All of these forecasts are realized in his person. All these prophecies are realized in him. The so-called Christian Kabbalah, iconoclasm, nominalism, the rejection of anything of Christian culture is, of course, destroyed with iconoclasm and good works. This renewed interest in the Gematria, Luther's very favorable statements about Jews early in his career. For Jews at the time, especially Kabbalists, only has one meaning. And Halevi says, now through the man that we've mentioned above, men in great numbers and of high repute are proceeding towards the goal of conversion. Time alone will, with God's help, enlighten us as to the ultimate fate of these men. Halevi was concerned that Luther didn't know really what he was doing, and he wasn't, in the mind of the Kabbalist, was not subjectively aware of what he was doing. Halevi says, God's right hand is outstretched to accept them, meaning the Protestants, before the advent of the Messiah. For after that, they're no longer acceptable. You see, Jews don't tolerate converts. especially after the rise of the Haredi and after Khmelnytsky. No one is to become a Jew. That's not possible. This is, we're talking about an ethnic group with a genetic component. So conversion, again, is not another one of these terms that don't mean what it normally means. Conversion isn't to become a Jew. It's someone who accepts Jewish dominion without complaint. Now, of course, as we all know, Halevi's enthusiasm for Luther was a bit premature. Luther was not Cyrus. And you know, E. Michael Jones has said, even I was saying this before Jones said it. Many Russians and Ukrainians were saying this as well, that you had this messianic expectation in Jewish-run Poland, where a Jewish oligarchy controlled the money with no exceptions. It was an absolute Jewish utopia. But then came the Cossacks, who were not going to tolerate the humiliation of Christian people, their promotion of, you know, the destruction of churches, the promotion of prostitution, sexual revolution, everything that they were promoting, and came and slaughtered the elite of the Jewish population at the time. The Hasidim comes directly from there. The Hasidic Jews come directly from that. They were a bit too premature on this. German cities experienced substantial dislocation from the commercial expansion of the Renaissance. And Jews, of course, were expelled from these cities. Scholars, both Jewish and Gentile, say it was for no reason. They blamed them for the ills of society. No one explains why it's the same group of people, or actually a fragment of the same group of people, gets kicked out of city after city after city after city, hundreds of them, for no reason. Not anybody else. Not Armenians, who of course weren't Christians in the common mind. They were Monophysites. But were also very wealthy and very ethnically motivated. Arabs, same goes for them. Persians that weren't Jewish, same goes for them. Why weren't they removed? Why weren't the Karaites removed? Why weren't the Samaritans, the handful that were there, removed? Only followers of the Kabbalah, of the Talmud, were removed. More specifically, usury, anti-Christian agitation, support for prostitution and pornography, were the same charges rightfully leveled against Jews over and over again. In the 1480s, 1490s, this was the height of the expulsion, because this messianic expectation was developing with the Kabbalah, and they already, for people like Jan Hus, saw the revolution developing. Now Zwingli, successor to the first reformers, was very much acquainted with Kabbalah. And the Haggadah as well, the so-called Jewish legends. And in his method of exegesis, of course, he used esoteric Kabbalistic methods. Normally, for this kind of thing, you know, Christians go to the Church Fathers. No different than if you're going to interpret the Constitution, you go to the Founding Father. But these guys can't do that. They were cut off from the Church Fathers because they thought that they were corrupted Greek pagans. That's very convenient. Well, where do they go then? Well, they can't go to their own reason. They don't know enough. No one knows enough. They go to the Jews. Or actually, they go to the bankers, and then they go to the Jews. Pigut de Mirandola, Ruchlin, Zwingli, ultimately one and the same movement. In fact, Zwingli made use of Ruchlin's Rudimenta Hebraica, the rudiments of Hebrew, and followed all the controversies between Jews and Gentiles in Spain. The Arte Kabbalistica was written by Ruchlin and used by Zwingli. And we're not entirely sure if he read these at length, but he certainly was aware of their contents, and he employs Ruchlin's essential principle, the use of the Tetragrammaton in his argument in creation to defend his position. So they went to Jewish numerology because they had rejected the Church Fathers. Now, you know, most of these questions had long since been taken care of, but we're talking about the new revolution here. The new revolution, to parallel the banking revolution and the commercial revolution throughout Europe's cities, created a power vacuum. When Zwingli was a teacher in Basel and Switzerland, he approved many of the theses that come from the so-called Christian Kabbalists, and it was Pope Innocent VIII that had condemned him. Zwingli said, neither the cross of Christ nor any image ought to be adorned in the way of worship, that God cannot assume a nature of any kind whatsoever, but only a rational nature, that no science affords a better assurance of the divinity of Christ than magical or Kabbalistic science. So he wasn't shy, in this case, of saying that he was founded on the Kabbalah and numerology, and his understanding. This is what they mean by the study of the Old Testament. This is what they mean by the study of Hebrew. If you don't know the code words, you don't know what you're reading, and you don't know what you're talking about. You can't have a clearer admission than this. The connection between Pico, Pico, and the Medicis on the one hand, who financed the rise of the Kabbalah, bringing many Jews from Constantinople, to early Luther and Zwingli, needless to say, Calvin, it's impossible to deny this connection. And the material conditions were set out by, of course, this triangle of Jewish capital that allowed them to function, especially in Poland, which is where most of them lived, without having to worry about anything. They were the persecutors, not the other way around. Zwingli did believe that Jews were the chosen people, racially speaking. He goes on to say this, and of course he's steeped in the Talmud, he condemns idolaters. Zwingli says, the same covenant which he entered into with Israel has in these later days entered into with us, that we may be of one people with them, the Jews, one church, and may have one covenant. I suppose that some more vainly cry out, see how that fellow would make Jews of us, though we have always been told of two peoples, two churches, and two covenants. There's only one. Again, at least he's honest. He says that the covenant of the Jews has been borrowed, essentially, by the lesser Goyim. He denies Christ in favor of scientific paganism, which is easily deduced from what he says. There is one church, meaning that there is communion with those who revile Christ and those who love him. If that communion is possible, then he's not speaking of conversion, he's speaking of Jewish domination. Making matters worse, the more radical anti-Trinitarian, Michael Servetus, who's probably in Murano anyway, was deeply influenced by the Jews and may have become a full Jew at the end of his life. The so-called Pagini's Bible. And this is a period of time where, you know, the Reformation created this mythology that there is this book, this sacred book that came floating down from heaven, fully formed and fully translated, that contains everything. This is the Word of God, the words in this book. Today, people refer to the Bible. You know, we believe in the Bible, the literal Bible. It's an irritating concept because it's become an idol in and of itself. The Bible is a product of the church, only one of many. It has a very high level of significance because it's read during the liturgy, but so are the church fathers. It is not superior to other great works of the ascetics of the era. Again, the Bible and scriptures refer to two different things. To have a single Bible means that you only have one target to manipulate. The Orthodox Church has this great advantage where you have national churches, different synods all over the place, 1,000 different ways that someone can receive information, everything from the sacraments to the liturgy to icons to books. But the Reformation made it very easy to destroy Christianity because they said everything is between these two covers. Everything is between these two covers. Nothing is outside of it. So whoever gets control of the printing press controls what Christianity is. And the Pagini's Bible, which Severus had edited, blatantly comes out with Kabbalistic sources. He refers to the note in Genesis 49. He says, the thing that says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh come. Now, of course, all the church fathers refer to that as Christ. No, he refers here to King David. Like Oliver Cromwell, you can't take it at face value. King David isn't the historical King David in the Old Testament. It's a Kabbalistic symbol. The Kabbalah was his inspiration. Servetus even goes so far as to use concepts like Aeon, which is a Gnostic idea of the ages. But of course, the Hebraic would be Sephiroth. And so the whole Trinitarian, anti-Trinitarian movement comes directly from the Kabbalah and to a lesser extent the Talmud. And he cites from Abraham Saba and Isaac Arama and all these other people, the foundation of these radical movements at the same time as the Reformation. There's no question that the foundation is strictly, Judaic. But Luther himself, though of course later in his career had rejected a lot of this, the damage had already been done. He consistently used Nicholas of Lyra, who died in 1340, a Murano Jew. His explanations of the Old Testament come almost directly from Rashi of Troyes, rather than the Church Fathers, and he became the tool for interpreting Scripture. So the whole notion of sola scriptura had nothing to do with the individual reading a book. It wasn't a rejection of authority, it was which authority do you use. Luther steeped himself in rabbinical commentary. Now, he didn't necessarily accept them all, of course. But Rashi, Rabbi Solomon Rashi of Trier, was absolutely essential to him. But he also said that some of this stuff in the Talmud was dreams and fables, which of course it is. It's terrible reading. But he accuses the Jews of being responsible for the errors in Jerome's Vulgate because he used actual Hebrew writers in the ancient world, actually existed at the time, for assistance. He accused them of deliberately making errors. Of course, his problem really is with the use of Jerome for exegesis of scriptures. Luther borrowed very much from the rabbis, but he was unnecessarily not willing to give them credit. But like everyone else, the son of Calvin, he was eclectic. He used what he wanted to use. But Luther can't escape from any obligation to Jewish writings. And during the very early stage of his career, he brought in, I mean, he had an entire social circle, institutions that he founded, and Kabbalistic writers were brought in by the truckload. Shamira, Shlomo, Leo, three major Kabbalistic writers visited him in Wittenberg and expressed to him that Christians were now busying themselves with Hebraic lore. And by that, of course, they meant Gnosticism. They clearly believed and said to Luther, as he related, that the Reformation would bring Christians to accept Judaism. Of course, Lucifer expressed exactly the opposite. These Jews, whether they be Muranos or Kabbalist rabbi, soon tested Luther's patience. You had Kabbalistic writers taking Christian names, as Solomon HaLevi took the name Paul de Santa Maria. Joshua Lorkey became Geronimo de Santa Fe. It was an infiltration process. But the converts were relatively small, but not inconsequential. I mean, even Peppercorn was a Jewish convert. But it was this Jewish issue, whether or not the Talmud should be burned, or the Zohar should be burned, brought Jewish concerns to light. The job of writers like Victor von Karban, Emmanuel Tremelius, these were Muranos who began rewriting the Bible according to the Old Testament, according to the Tetragrammaton. Yoach and Isaac, and son Stephen, they were rewriting Jerome's Vulgate. So this wasn't not just essential for the Reformation, but for the so-called progressive Catholics like Erasmus and people like this. Even in America, the process continued and continued and continued. Judaic revival. You see, oftentimes when you read about the Judaic revival in, say, the Puritans, now the Puritans were almost strictly a Jewish group, without actually being Jews, which of course was the purpose, the end The war against James I was the war against Amalek from 1600 to 1650. So, you know, from James I to the Restoration, there was an explosion of Kabbalah in Britain and in very early America. Brian Walton, who wrote Polyglot 1657, gave thanks to Cromwell for his help. The rabbinical literature was all over the place. They introduced the Mosaic Code as a fundamental law. This was one of the things that the Puritans did in early America. Cromwell had suggested to these people that they appoint 70 members of the Privy Council in accordance with the number of the Jewish Sanhedrin. Well, the problem is, claiming that, you know, we're going to follow the law of God in America, as a Puritan said, that's not interesting. All Christian nations follow the law of the Old Testament in many ways. But when Cromwell makes reference to the Sanhedrin, he's well aware of what he's talking about. It's their materialist ideology that's at the foundation here. The Puritan Sabbath serves to intensify the alliance of Puritan and Jewish interests. 1653, Major Thomas Harrison, an Anabaptist, publicly advocated in Parliament the adoption of Talmudic legislation. The Levellers announced their physical descent from the Jewish race. No, they're not British Israelites, but they're talking about a racial connection with a financial, ideological connection with the so-called Sanhedrin, which they knew was a path to wealth and power. They even compared the tyranny that they suffered connected to our ancestors in Egypt. They called their opponents Amalekites, just as the Hussites had called their enemies Philistines. And they demanded the introduction of the Torah as halam, or the literature of Europe, the norm for English laws. The rule of the Talmud was meant to be institutionalized by these people. If you know the code and if you know the language, it starts making sense. I mean, even the Fifth Monarchy men welcomed Rabbi Manasseh ben Israel to England so that he could, and this was the group that brought the Jews in under Cromwell. After the 1296, the initial expulsion under Edward, the economy of Britain expanded. You know, the work week was 20 hours. The currency, which wasn't very widespread, was extremely stable. There was simply no inflation. There was a great degree of 25, Leviticus 25 was followed. Usury was banned. Cromwell changed all of that. The Fifth Monarchy men preached the belief that before the advent of the monarchy of the Messiah, or what we call Antichrist, the Jews will be restored to the Holy Land, the 10 tribes would be found, and the Jewish Messiah, an offspring of the house of Jesse, would appear in accordance with what they think prophecy is. So you have the same messianic tendencies in England, and you see it in America as well. E. Michael Jones says this: the old idea was a notion that the millennium meant the restoration of the terrestrial kingdom of the Jews. The idea which had been condemned, but not destroyed, by the Council of Ephesus in 431. The new name for the old idea was revolution. When the ghetto was cracked open, but not destroyed, by the blows that were inflicted on it by Khmelnytsky, and most devastating of all, the disillusionment which followed on the heels of the false messiah's conversion to Islam, the concept of revolution escaped through those cracks in the ghetto walls into European culture at large, where it was implemented at first by Judaizers, like the Puritans, and finally by the revolutionary Jew in propria persona, at the helm of his own political movement to produce via socialism, Marxism, Zionism, sexual liberation, neoconservatism, the kingdom of Jews, or heaven on earth. He's making the same argument that I've made, and many in the Orthodox Church have made, as well as the traditional Roman Catholics. The connection here is very clear. The Renaissance is essential, and the rise of banking in the Medici clan. They financed, through the Jews of Constantinople, who they brought to Italy, the rise of the scientistic alchemy that revolutionized society, to materialize society as the Sanhedrin always wanted. These so-called scholars were given money by Medici's like Pico or Ficino, then were met with people like Ruschlin, who then heavily influenced Luther in his early years, and then most certainly Zwingli and Calvin. But the essential notion here, and one of the things that makes this such a complicated area, is that when you read the literature in the field, you can't assume that terms like Hebrew or God or matter or the Noachidal or whatever it is means what we think. For example, from the Jewish Encyclopedia, these are the so-called seven Noachide laws. Do not deny God, no idolatry. Do not blaspheme God. Do not murder. Do not engage in incestuous, adulterous, or homosexual relationships. Do not steal. Do not eat a live animal. And to establish courts and legal system to ensure obedience. Those are the Noachide laws. Now, most of us know they've been installed in America. A lot of idiots think that this is an actual law here. Already in 1990, it was George Bush signed the Joint Resolution, Public Law 102-4. And of course, their symbol is the rainbow, used by homosexuals as well as the Barozbadan, Zionist entity in Eastern Russia that we've dealt with on this show, Southern Siberia. But, you know, rejection of idolatry, do not blaspheme, do not murder. You know, these should not be taken at face value. They're exoteric utterances. For anyone to read these things and say that they mean what they say shouldn't be teaching at a university. I mean, theft and murder are always forbidden, so why mention it? Well, court systems are everywhere. Well, why is this mentioned? Well, the Babylonian Talmud makes it clear that idolatry is defined as a false prophet, Jesus Christ, and worthy of death. That Christ was a blasphemer, a violator of the second Noahide precept. This makes his worshippers, and of course that we believe in the Trinity, blasphemers and worthy of death. Noahide laws have to be interpreted by someone who understands Jewish ideology. In the book Jewish Utopia, 1932, which is actually written by a Talmudist named Michael Higger, which is very accessible and very interesting reading. He says, in general, the peoples of the world will be divided into two main groups, Israelites and non-Israelites. The former will be righteous. They will live according to the wishes of one universal God. Everyone else, on the other hand, will be known for their detestable practices, idolatry, similar acts of wickedness. They will be destroyed and disappear from the earth before the ushering of the ideal era. Consequently, idolatry and idol worshippers, wicked people, unrighteous nations will disappear from the earth. Jewish polemics is always based on the number two. The dualities exist everywhere, enlightened and ignorant, esoteric and exoteric, Jews and goyim, proletarians and bourgeois, kulak and peasant, Israelite, non-Israelite, gold and lead, many others. Wherever Jews have had any power over the goyim, it's been very bloody. But it's made easier when you divide the world into two neat categories. It spreads the Judaic ideology over humanity, which, of course, for us, you know, they consider us animals, and they manipulate language so as to make their rule more palatable to us. You take Jewish ideology, you use secular terms to disguise it, and you have secular modern ideology. So you have people, mobs forming to protect Jewish interests and to despise their own. This is simply because of the manipulation of language and the fact that it takes a specialist to read this material. Most of it is deeply encoded. The encoding goes back as ancient Jewish history. The claim is to protect themselves. The non-Jews, I mean, I read the entire Talmud, that alone makes me worthy of death. It says right in there that anyone, any non-Jew who reads this will be killed or neutralized. Encoding things, you need the Jewish Encyclopedia to, you know, interpret some of this stuff. Encoding things is a way to write down things that are actually esoteric. Because esoteria, by definition, can't be written down. The only way to get around that is if you use code words, like Isaac Newton did. So you read this stuff and the words that they use have no bearing. It sounds rational, you know, or very simple, like the stupid laws I just mentioned. you know, I say, you know, no adultery. Well, the Talmud makes it very clear that if the, your mistress is non-Jewish, it's not adultery, it's bestiality, which is acceptable. So nothing here can be taken at face value. That's the worst part of all of this. So you have Harvard professors going around, you know, pontificating on this stuff, believing that the Jews were the people of the Old Testament, and that when they refer to the Torah, they're referring to the first five books, you know, the ignorance. You know, Jews are screaming that this isn't, you know, in the ancient world and the medieval world and now, that that's not true. And the Talmud remains hidden from everybody. The last thing I'll mention is the Jewish virtual library. They say this about the Reformation. They say, well, from the very first moment, the Jews appreciated the element of revolutionary breakthrough, as they had done much earlier in relation to other heretical and revolutionary movements of Christianity, as evident in their disputations and the attitude towards the Hussites. Old traditions and ideas looked to change in Christianity and would bring back its beliefs to the right Jewish way that they had erroneously departed from. Well, clearly here, the Protestant Reformation has a Judaic foundation. The Jews refer to themselves as God. The Ein Sof can only be formed, brought into being, by Jewish power. The Antichrist, and I'll be dealing with this some other time, I've dealt with it. Oh, actually, I have dealt with it before. The Antichrist is not a person in the sense that we use the word person. If it's a single individual, he'd be immediately exposed. How stupid. You know, these are brilliant deceivers here. This is Satan himself. He's not going to be so obvious. Adam Kadmon. The ideal individual, created by a hidden elite. Adam Kadmon is Antichrist. That's the post-revolutionary new man that almost every revolution from the Reformation to today makes reference to. It is a man, it's a person, but it's an ideal person that has yet to exist. It's a conceptual person, but it is seen as an individual. It's not the golem. It'll be brought about in part by the golem. Judaism is based on hatred for Christianity, hatred for logos. Their entire existence is based on it. Protestant Reformation should be abandoned as a cancer that destroys everything it touches. It creates liberalism. It creates modernity. It is the foundation for industrialism. It is a horrible cancer. And like all of these revolutionary movements in Western European life, it, of course, has a Jewish root. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.